The book of Exodus isn't just a story. It's the journey of God's people, a people who had forgotten. For 400 years, they waited, feeling forgotten and abandoned. But God had not forgotten them. In the midst of their pain, he hears their cries. God raises up Moses to confront the world's most powerful empire. And through miraculous signs and wonders, he leads his people to freedom. But Exodus is more than just a story of escape. It's a journey of transformation. Exodus isn't just a story from the past. It's your story. Through the narrative of forgetfulness, we see God's unwavering faithfulness, always remembering your name. It foreshadows the ultimate rescue through Jesus, a plan that's always been in place. It was God's plan since the beginning.
Good morning. So 17 years ago, my wife and I built the house that we currently live in. And at that time, our children were ages 10, 8, 6, and 4. And when I say that we built our house, we had people who did most of the heavy lifting. But we did do little projects in the house. And so like one of my favorite things was at the end of the day, after working, my whole family would go over to the house and I would do whatever projects I could do. Like I did wood floors, other stuff like that. And our kids would hang out with us. And sometimes they'd go into one of the bedrooms that we were building and they'd watch a movie, or they would just go outside and play. And since we're Gen Xers, we do free-range parenting. So our kids got to go outside and play. Don't judge us. And so one of my favorite memories of that time is I was working on the wood floors on the first floor of our house, and I'm looking out all the glass windows in the back, and our lot backed up to this wooded area back there, and I saw my six-year-old Ethan just darting across the yard toward the woods. And so I thought, this is interesting. I'm just going to watch and see what happens. And back in the wooded area, there was this tree that sat at like a 45-degree angle, like that. And so he went running at the tree, and when he got to the tree, he just kept running up the tree. And so he's running up the tree, and then all of a sudden, I think, realizes what he has done, and he jumps and hugs the tree. And so being a good Gen X parent, I just waited to see how this thing was all going to unfold. And he just hugged the tree for a while, and then I heard his little voice yell out, "Dad!" So I sauntered back into the backyard, back to the tree, and I got there. When I got close enough to the tree, he was above my head. He was like at least 7 or 8 feet off the ground on this tree. And all I said simply to him was, "I got you. I got you." Those three words are so powerful, aren't they? Because in that moment when I said, "I got you," he just kind of melted off the tree into my arms and I took him down from the tree. I got you. I had a similar experience this week when I was talking to Pastor Justin about some insecurities that I have and a situation that's happening in life right now that is kind of reigniting these. And he didn't say these exact words, but essentially what he said to me was, "I got you." Just as a brother in Christ, he said, "I got you." And I felt my anxiety sort of melt away. We're in a series right now working our way through the Old Testament book of Exodus, and today we find ourselves on dry land. Last week, the Israelites had crossed over from, someone moved my ribbon, that's good. I'll just go find the spot. So we found ourselves in dry land. Last week, they had crossed the Red Sea, and now God had miraculously saved the people. The Egyptian army with Pharaoh and all of his leaders were floating now lifeless in the water, and God had saved his people, and they were finally on their way to the promised land. And what we're going to do today is we're going to cover three chapters, so we're going to kind of skip our way through them. But what we're going to see in these three chapters is God, the people are going to face five tests, and their response in each one of these five tests is going to be they're going to test God back. And God's response to each one of them is going to be essentially these words. I got you. And there's a significance for us on these pages because it doesn't have to take any kind of masterful interpretation to find it in our lives, because every one of us faces a myriad of tests every day. For some of you, the test might be a health challenge that is new or is ongoing, or it might be a new job or a lack of a job. It could be financial difficulty, or maybe you're grappling with forgiving somebody that has hurt you so bad, and yet you know you're supposed to forgive them. So each one of us has these tests every day, and quite often, our response to facing a test is to test God. Like, are you powerful enough to save me? Are you merciful enough to give me grace when I fall, right? And his response to us is going to be an easy one. It's going to be, I got you. There's nothing today that's tricky or surprising about the message. There's no twists, there's no turns. It is a straightforward message, and I think it's one that we all need to be reminded of again and again and again. So let's look at it and look at God's faithfulness toward us, starting in Exodus 15. We're going to start in verse 22. It says, "Then Moses led Israel on from the Red Sea, and they went out of the wilderness of Shur, and they journeyed for 3 days in the wilderness without finding water. They came to Marah because they could not drink the water at Marah because it was bitter. That is why it was named Marah." By the way, Marah just means bitter. "The people grumbled to Moses, 'What are we going to drink?'" Now, I want you to put yourself in their shoes for a second. God has rescued you from 400 years of enslavement in Egypt, right? He defeated your enemies by miraculously parting the Red Sea, and now it's time to follow this great big pillar of cloud. And God says, just follow the pillar, and every day it'll show you where to go, and then it'll turn to flame, and you'll know it's time to stop for the night, and we're going to do this until we reach the promised land. And so imagine that first day, all of your excitement, right? And so you load up your donkey with everything you have, you fill every container you have with water, and you set out. And at the end of the day, after wandering and following this cloud through the desert, you stop because it turns into fire, and you set up camp, and your kids run around and play, and you sit by the fire stretching out your tired legs, and then in the next morning, you do the same thing all over again. But the donkey's load is a little lighter because there's less food and less water. And that day again, you follow the cloud for another long day. And again, you go marching through the wilderness with 2 million other people through the hot desert. And you follow the cloud for another long day. And you set up camp again. And the next morning, you break camp again. And you load up again. And the donkey is a little lighter because the water supply is beginning to run dangerously low, and your kids are complaining that they're thirsty, and you're looking at your animals who are now starting to move slower because they don't have water either. And at the end of that day, when you set up camp for the third time, your panic would start to set in, right? Because the next morning when you got up, your containers would be bone dry. And as you wearily start out again, because the cloud starts to lead again, you see it just in time. On the horizon, right there. You don't know if it's a mirage or not, but as you get closer, you realize it is a source of water. And just like every movie we've ever seen of somebody who's really thirsty, right? 2 million people run up and stick their faces in the water as fast as they can to drink, but they spit it back out. It's so gross. It's bitter. It has either like a high mineral content or it's just gross. It's like drinking ocean water. And it feels like a cruel joke, right? To finally see water and to plunge your face into the water and have it be absolutely undrinkable, every single one of us would grumble. There's not one of us in this room that would not have said what the Israelites said, which is, what are we going to drink? Right? Every one of us who is a parent would have worried about our kids. Every shepherd would have worried about our sheep. This is not an unreasonable request to ask Moses, what are we going to drink? And so Moses then, it says, cries out to the Lord. And the Lord showed him a tree. And when he threw the tree into the water became drinkable. How did that happen? A lot of people try to come up with a lot of reasons. I'll give you mine. I don't know. Like, how does a burning bush not burn up, right? Like how does the Nile turn into blood? How does the Red Sea part? I don't know. It's supernatural. It's a miracle. And so they finally had water to drink, and they drank their fill. And the Lord made a statute and ordinance for them at Marah, and he tested them there. And he said, if you will carefully obey the Lord your God, do what is right in his sight, pay attention to his commands, and keep all his statutes, I will not inflict any illnesses on you that I inflicted on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 date palms, and they camped there by the water. So at this place named Marah, where the people and the water were bitter, God gave them a statute and an ordinance. That was actually one thing, a statute and an ordinance and a test. And the statute and ordinance were a simple but impossible task. God is like, listen, I need you just to do what is right in God's eyes, in my eyes, not yours. In other words, I get to pick what's right, right? I get to decide what's right. You just got to do it. And he says, and as long as you do all of it, in other words, as long as you are perfect, as long as you don't fail, as long as you completely believe in me, you totally nail it, then things are going to go well for you. That was the statute. And then there was the test, right? The test here is can you do this perfectly? Because if you can do it perfectly, you're going to be fine. And they called himself a new name. He called himself Jehovah Rapha, which means the God who heals. He says, just nail this and I'll be the God who heals. He then brought them from a place called Bitter to a place called Elim. And by the way, Elim is a fancy name that means tree. That's it. So Elim is tree, but it was an oasis for them finally. It was a beautiful oasis with springs of water where they could just give water to their animals and they could soak their bones, and there were date palms that they could stock up on food. It was a wonderful respite for them, but there's foreshadowing in the name of the place they went to next. It says, the entire Israelite community departed from Elim, tree, and came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had left Egypt. The entire Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand. In other words, if only God had killed us instead of rescuing us. By his hand, if he had killed us, we would have been happy if God had killed us in the land of Egypt when we sat by pots of meat and ate all the bread we wanted. Instead, you, Moses, brought us into the wilderness to make this whole assembly die of hunger. This whole thing is the whole play on repeat, right? And this brings us to test number two. Back in the desert at first, the test was we don't have enough water, and then God provided. And now it is we don't have the food that we want. All they had was water and some leftover dates from the oasis, right? And all they wanted was meat and bread. And I'm sorry to those of you who are vegans or gluten-free folks, you celiac people, but meat and bread, come on, right? Like, I could just eat meat and bread every single day. And the Israelites were just dreaming. They were salivating for meat and bread, so much so that they're like, you know what? We wish that God had just killed us in Egypt while we were eating meat and bread. We that's all we want. We want meat and bread, right? We don't want just dates and water, right? And so this is amazing. Then the Lord said to Moses, I'm going to rain bread from heaven on you. And that's exactly what happened. He went on to explain that this was a new menu he was going to serve them with. Every evening, when they had set up their camp, God would send quail, so many quail, into their camp that they would be able to collect all that they needed, all their fill of meat. And then in the morning, there would be a dew that would turn into fine flakes when it dried, and it would look like coriander seed, but it would taste like honey. And they would have now meat and bread every day, meat and bread, meat and bread, meat and bread. God says it this way to them. The Lord said, I have heard the complaints of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will eat bread until you are full. I'm going to stuff you with meat and bread. then you will know that I am the Lord your God. But there was a tiny little catch, a test, test number three. He said to them, each day, I want you to only collect the amount that you need for that day. I don't want you to grab a week's supply. I don't want you to grab 2 days' supply. Every day, you're just going to grab 1 day's worth. Because if you keep any overnight, the next morning, it is going to be maggoty, right? So you don't want that in your house. So just trust me every day. And then on Fridays, this is what's crazy. He's like, on Fridays, I want you to collect twice as much. And miraculously, the next morning on Saturday, there will be enough and it will not be maggoty. He was basically teasing a law that is to come, the law of the Sabbath, right? But let me just read this long section to you. It says, on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much food. That's what they were told to do, 4 quarts apiece. And all the leaders of the community came and reported that to Moses. And he told them, this is what the Lord said. Tomorrow is a day of complete rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you want to bake, boil what you want to boil, and set aside everything left over to be kept until morning. So they set it aside until morning, as Moses commanded, and it didn't stink or have maggots in it. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is the Sabbath of the Lord. Today you won't find any in the field. For 6 days you will gather it. On the seventh day on the Sabbath there'll be none. Yet on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather. Right? Of course they did. But they did not find any. And then the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commands and instructions? Understand, the Lord has given you the Sabbath, and therefore on the sixth day, he will give you 2 days' worth of bread. Each of you stay where you are. No one is to leave his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. And this sounds like just a silly little narrative, but this is, in a sense, the hardest test that they had to face yet. Because this test is, can you trust God enough today to give you what you need for today? Can you trust God enough that he's told you he will take care of tomorrow so that you can actually rest on that day? In other words, it's just like what Jesus famously told his disciples to pray, give us this day our daily bread, not our weekly bread, not our monthly bread, not our quarterly bread, but can we trust God today to provide what we need today? And this is not a one-time occurrence. This whole thing that he gives them, it repeats itself every day for 40 years. The Israelites ate manna for 40 years until they came to the inhabited land. They ate manna until they reached the border of the land of Canaan. I am a fairly easy person to feed. I like to say that my love language is not picking what I eat. Just put food in front of me and I'm happy. That's how I am. So my wife recently left town for a month and she's like, do you need me to stock up? And I'm like, don't worry, whatever's there, I will eat. And so I grazed for a while and then started running out of stuff. And then I came up with a brilliant plan. I made this giant pot of chili and I decided I'd eat it for every meal for a week. I even made it with Two Hearted because IPAs are the pumpkin spice lattes for white men. And so I made this pot of chili. And after about 2.5 days, like I ate something else for breakfast, but 2.5 days, like lunch, dinner, lunch, dinner, lunch, I began to crave anything but chili. The Israelites ate the same food for 40 years. Like there was a whole generation that grew up that thought there were only two food groups, quail and manna, meat and bread. And now it's time for test four. Exodus 17, the entire Israelite community left the wilderness of Sin, moving from one place to the next according to the Lord's command. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So the people complained to Moses, give us water to drink. And he said, why are you complaining to me? Why are you testing the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water and grumbled against Moses. And he said, why did you ever bring us from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? And Moses cried out to the Lord, what should I do with these people? In a little while, they're going to stone me. Right? So Moses is starting to panic. Like somebody picks up a rock one day. He's like, what are you doing with the rock? Nothing. Right? He's like, he's starting to worry. And the Lord answered Moses, go on ahead of the people and take some of the elders of Israel with you. Take the staff you struck the Nile with in your hand and go. I am going to stand there in front of you on the rock at Horeb. Does anybody remember where Horeb is? Anyone? This is going all the way back in the series, weeks and weeks ago. Horeb was where Moses was when he encountered the burning bush. That was at Horeb. So hold on to that, right? So they're now at Horeb, right? And it says, when you hit the rock, water will come out of it and the people will drink. And Moses did this in the sights of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites complained and because they tested the Lord saying, is the Lord among us or not? I could preach a whole sermon on these three verses. Right? They're at Horeb, and Moses had at that spot encountered God. And what did God say to him out of the burning bush when Moses asked for a sign? He's like, what sign will you have for me? Give me a sign that I can give the people that you're real, that you're really going to take us to the promised land. Does anybody remember the sign? It was in Exodus 3, where God said to him, I will certainly be with you, and this will be the sign that I am the one who sent you. When you bring the people out of Egypt, you will all worship God at this mountain. And here they were. At this place that God said they were going to worship him, they're there. And then this is crazy. God says, I'm going to stand on the rock, and I want you to hit the rock where I am standing. That's a bizarre statement, right? God's like, he's like, don't worry, I'm going to be on the rock, so you just hit me. Like, I'm going to be on the rock, just hit it, and water's going to flow so the people can drink, and that's exactly what happened. And the fun part is that Moses now names that spot with a new name. He calls it Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means quarreling. I love that. He's like, I'm going to name it after you whiny people. And now, the final test, test number 5. At Rephidim, Amalek came and fought against Israel. And this was a completely different kind of test. It was a war. The people didn't have time to complain because they had to fight. And this is how the fight went down. God sent Moses up to the top of this hill that was overlooking the battle. And he told him to go up there with his brother Aaron and a guy named Hur. We don't know for sure who Hur is, but we think that it's probably his sister Miriam's husband. So it's probably his brother-in-law. We don't know that for sure, but Josephus, an early Jewish writer, says that it was. So we're going to just think that, right? We don't know for sure, but the story is wild. So God sends him up to the top of the hill and tells him to carry his staff with him. And I was going to bring a staff up here with me. Didn't have one, but I did find a piece of conduit backstage. So I figured that's good enough. And what basically God says to Moses is, all I want you to do for this battle, it's an easy battle. All you got to do is take that staff, and I want you to lift it above your head. And he goes, and as long as you hold it above your head, Israel will win the battle. That's it. That's all you got to do. Just hold this thing above your head. And if you lower your hand, they're going to begin to lose. This was like Old Testament CrossFit, okay? And let's not forget that Moses was 80 years old. Did anyone watch the Tyson-Jake Paul fight on Friday night, right? I stayed up way too late for that fight. Mike Tyson is a beast. But he's old, right? And after the first two rounds, he couldn't do it anymore. You can just kind of see he's starting to wind down after two rounds. He was wearing out. That's what I think it was like with Moses. He was 80 years old. And imagine the immense pressure, the pressure, not just of the physical pressure of holding this staff above his head, but the emotional pressure of knowing if you lower your hand, people you love will die. And so Moses had to keep his hands up here. He had to hold his hands like the strength of a much younger man, but just like Mike Tyson, he goes a couple rounds and he can't do it anymore. His arms start to come down, so his brother Aaron and his brother-in-law Hur, they give him a rock to sit on, and then they stood on either side of him and they grabbed his hands and supported his hands as he held them up all day until the sun went down and they won the battle. And for me, that is a beautiful picture for every single one of us, isn't it? God gives us commands to do, but we're not meant to do them alone. None of us, not even leaders, not even somebody like Moses can do it alone. No one can hold their arms up all day like that. I definitely can. I'm old. So watch Moses' reaction here in verse 14 to 16 after they won the battle. The Lord then said to Moses, write this down on a scroll as a reminder and recite it to Joshua. Joshua was the commander who was leading the battle. He said, I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. He said, indeed, my hand is lifted up toward the Lord's throne. The Lord will be at war with Amalek from generation to generation. In other words, I just held my hands up, pointing them up toward the Lord. He is the banner. He does the battle. This is all I have to do. Three chapters, five tests, two new names of God. Earlier we had Jehovah Rapha, the God who heals, and now he gives him the name Yahweh Nissi, the Lord is my banner. And Nissi refers to a tall pole with a banner on it that battle would happen and rally around. Do you see the pattern here of salvation embedded in these verses? It's astonishing. The people grumble and God saves them. 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 The army attacks and God saves them. And then right in the middle, he gives them an ordinance, a statue, and a test. But it was impossible, right? It was a test they couldn't do, and it was a test they immediately failed in the wilderness of sin, right? They were told, all you got to do is perfectly obey me. And they couldn't do it. And yet God saved them. And did you see how he did it? This is so amazing. Moses threw a tree into bitter water, and it became clean. Moses became the target of the Israelites' wrath and the messenger of God when he gave them quail and Moses. Moses had the anger of God directed at him when the Israelites broke the Sabbath. Moses hit the rock where God was standing to bring forth water. Moses, in weakness, was lifted up high on a hill with his arms outstretched until he brought the victory. Do you see that Moses here, as we have seen time and time again in Exodus, is telling us the story of Jesus? The story of Jesus who makes the bitter clean. Jesus who absorbs the wrath of men and the wrath of God and gives us our daily bread and our living water. Jesus who was lifted up high on the hill with his arms stretched out when he was crucified in weakness on a cross until he brought victory. And Jesus who was the rock that was struck to bring forth life. Listen to what we're told in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians. This is now, I don't want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were under the cloud. All passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food. They all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. That rock was Christ, the provider of our daily bread, the fountain of living water, the one who was struck so that we might have life. And all we do is we believe in him. And one of the gifts he gives us as we struggle to believe in him is other people to help lift up our arms to help us through. You might be facing health challenges. Maybe they're new. Maybe you're facing a new job or the lack of a job or financial difficulty or you're struggling to forgive somebody that hurt you so bad and you know you should forgive them. It's not on you to figure this out alone. Your rock is Christ. He's got you. He's the one who provides the daily bread, just what you need every day. That just when you think you're at the end of your rope, he provides you the living water that you need. He has surrounded you with a spiritual family so that you don't have to go it alone. Every day for 40 years, the Israelites had to wake up and trust that the manna was going to be there. They had to collect twice as much on Friday to trust God that they could go a day without work and allow him to continue to be God, right? Maybe this week, take a clue from that. And when you get up in the morning, just take a minute to acknowledge that Jesus is your living water, your daily bread. Maybe before you dive into all the tests and trials that are going to come your way, take a minute in prayer. Read a little of his word and talk to him. As you sip your morning coffee, just say, today I'm going to trust him to provide for me no matter what meets me today. And then when you panic and freak out because you're not going to be able to do it, pick up your phone and text somebody because you got people. It's one of the gifts that he's given us as well. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for Jesus, who is the rock who is struck, the rock who becomes provides us with daily bread and living water. And we acknowledge that we are so much like the Israelites. No matter how many times you provide for us, we panic and grumble, and then you save us. And we panic and grumble, and you save us. And so we just thank you that we believe that you're going to do it again. And so we just pray that you would grow inside of us an increased faith and trust in you, and that you would surround us with people that will hold up our arms when we're too weak to do it. We thank you that that is one of the expressions of the body of Christ in our lives. And we pray this all in Jesus' saving name. Amen.